the UCR Podcast.
Happy Friday, everybody. James Michael of 6 a.m. is an interesting guy because if you only know James from his work with that band, there's a lot more to know. Over the years, he has worked as a songwriter and producer with artists including Motley Crue, of course, but also Sammy Hagar, Meatloaf, Scorpions, The X's, Hilary Duff, Jax Mannequin, Papa Roach, and the list goes on and on. Today, we're going to talk about that side of his career and the unexpected pivot that he made thanks to 6 a.m. As you are hearing this, you can get your hands on a new triple vinyl edition that brings together the band's 2016 albums, Prayers for the Damned and Prayers for the Blessed, for the first time as one collective work on smoke-colored vinyl, as well as all of the streaming services. You can find more information on the vinyl set at the group's website, 6ammusic.com. Thanks for listening to the UCR Podcast. It is Matt Wardlaw. Make sure to follow us so you will get future editions of the pod as they're released. And of course, point your devices to Ultimate Classic Rock so you can stay in tune with everything about your favorite music. Here's our conversation with James Michael of 6 a.m. Enjoy. I'm super stoked that these records are going to be back out there on vinyl and like together for the first time. I think that, you know, it's hopefully folks will, you know, if they missed it the first time around, hopefully they'll get a chance to discover these because these are really cool records.
You know, that's cool that you say that. I feel very similarly about it. When they told me that they were thinking about doing this re-release and kind of packaging them together, I got really excited because, you know, when we made these two records, we always intended them to be, you know, mates. We intended them to go together. And just because it was such a crazy time making them one after the other and we were touring, I never really felt like they got connected the way that we had intended them to get connected. They both got released, but there was, you know, a fair amount of time in between those two releases. So I'm really excited about this.
Prayers for the Blessed and Prayers for the Damned really kind of illustrates what I've always loved about this band. Like, you guys were always pushing the envelope, moving things forward in such interesting ways. Like, if we talk about this as a project, like, what did this project look like at the outset? Like, when do you realize it's going to be two albums? And I guess, how did the, I'll say, conceptual nature of the two records kind of take shape?
Yeah, we knew it from the outset that we were going to do two records. It was just kind of, it was something that we had talked to the label about and they liked the idea and we felt it was kind of a bold move. And so when we started writing songs, we literally were writing songs for two albums. And then we would write it, you know, we'd write a song and then we'd kind of have to determine, is this going to be on Blessed or is this going to be on Damned? Where does this fit into the arc, you know, into the storyline? So that was fun, but we knew from the very beginning that it was going to be two. And it was quite a daunting task because we were also touring at the time. So that was a lot of music for us to have to write. And I think about halfway through, we were like, what have we gotten ourselves into? You know, this is maybe we bit off more than we can chew. But in the end, you know, we just put one foot in front of the other and kept on writing songs until we felt that we had the right collection of songs and we felt that there was kind of an arc to it.
And for you, like, when you're doing something like this, like, as you mentioned, like, you're touring as all this is going on, like, you know, off and on, like, how much does that kind of inform, you know, the process of making the records? Like, as there's of course the good sense that you're out there playing shows, so it's like you're well oiled when you go into the studio, but it seems like to me, man, from my perception, you guys are probably always pretty well oiled anyway when you go in the studio, but that energy couldn't hurt.
No, it absolutely helped. And I think that those two albums are really the only two albums that actually reflect that, exactly what you just said. It was, we were a touring band at that point. When we were writing songs, we had a much clearer idea of how these songs were going to translate live. And we would make adjustments based on what we thought was going to work well live. Whereas on the first three records, we really didn't have that. We had done some touring. But it was, you know, those were much more just studio conceptual albums, whereas I feel like Blessed and Damned really did reflect a band that had figured out what it was like to be on the road. We had, by then we had really admitted to ourselves that we were a band, that we were a touring band, and so it was a different experience. And I do think that it did inform our writing for sure, and it informed the production and maybe even the way that it was mixed.
Yeah, and I mean, you kind of alluded to this, but just the way this band even came together is so interesting. And just generally, what do you think from your side were kind of the original drivers behind the sound of what you guys end up doing? Like, what were the three of you envisioning, perhaps, and what kind of bands and things perhaps were influencing the idea of what takes shape with 6 a.m.?
That's a great question. I think that we each brought a real history to it, obviously. You know, DJ was deeply steeped in like Elvis Presley as a young boy. He was ex incredibly inspired by Elvis Presley. I was much more inspired by kind of the 70s British invasion or British pop, British punk type of music. I always tended to have a little bit more of a European flair to what I would gravitate towards. And then of course Nicky, you know, we all know what his, you know, his influences were very clear both in Motley and in 6 AM. So we brought very different passions together. And I would say that we just found that balance. You know, when I listen back to even our first record or our second record, I can hear things where I'm like, oh yeah, that was a Joe Jackson thing right there, or, you know, that, you know, whatever. I just any little influence that would come to mind, we would find a way to work it into our sound, and that really was what ended up giving 6 AM that whatever that sound was.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, the interesting part of everything that was going on was that, like, at the time that you kind of, from where I'm sitting, you yourself kind of wind up in like the Alan Kovac Beyond Music kind of universe. And perhaps even before that, like, you had this thing going on where you were like this songwriting, this collaborator guy, this producer guy, like you had like all these things that had to have ultimately, in one sense, all those experiences also contributed to what you end up doing with this band. And I think that's an interesting path for anybody that comes up going, I want to be in the music business. I want to, you know, be in a band, I want to write songs, whatever it is you think you want to do. It's like, as you know, James, like there's ultimately that point where it's like, once you, in this case, like you're a guy that, you know, comes from Michigan, goes out to California, like once you make that big move, like we've seen this in countless documentaries, like once people like show up in California, then it's like they have that moment, those moments where they start to find out, here's what I want to do, but here's kind of really my secret power. So like just looking at everything you've done, like what's with some hindsight, like what's the moment for you that you can look and go where you kind of started to realize, like, this is kind of my thing?
Well, it's interesting because before 6 AM even became a thing, I was really, I had given up my rock star dreams, years before, and was very, very content as a producer and as a songwriter and or a recording engineer. I really loved that. I really loved the shaping of sounds, and that to me was the most exciting thing about the business. And I had no intention of being a singer again. So when we all got together and started writing, The idea at the time was I was just going to help write the stuff, and then I was just going to produce it, and eventually we would find a singer to replace my vocals on there. So I just put my vocals on there so we had something to listen back to. So my goals were almost always to be the behind the scenes guy. Then one thing led to another. We end up releasing music with my voice on it, and all of a sudden I was the lead singer in 6 AM. And that was very, very exciting for me because, like I said, those dreams of rock stardom had been set aside, very sincerely set aside. But I'll be honest with you, when I started touring with the band, and we had videos on MTV and stuff, I got excited. It was all of my dreams kind of, it's like I was reminded what those dreams were. And it felt even more exciting to me now because I had put those dreams on the back burner. But ultimately, being a producer, being the one that was responsible for shaping the sound and mixing and doing all of that was always my true love. I really enjoyed being the singer in 6 AM and had some amazing adventures. But the thing that I feel the most connection to, is the way that those albums sounded.
You hit on a lot of good stuff, and I think you kind of helped me really realize that, like, the distilled version of what I should have asked you is, because you said, like, you found yourself more comfortable prior to 6 a.m. in the background. What's the moment where you realize that? Like, because it's just like, it's such an obviously, it's an interesting tapestry when one day you're working, writing a song with Sammy Hagar. Another day you're working, on an album with, Desmond Child and the Scorpions. Like, work is different every day when you work, when you do it like that. Your job is different every day. But, like, what's the moment where you kind of realize that, like, this is really what I want to do? When did that happen? What was the project where that happens?
There were a lot of those moments, and they were all very different. You mentioned Sammy Hagar, and I remember one time I had written a song with him, and I was out doing some radio promo for my Inhale album. And I was walking down the jetway to get on a plane, and Sammy called me, and he's like, "Dude, you got a second?" I'm like, "Yeah, sure. What's up?" He goes, "I want to play you the mix." And so he plays me the mix over the phone as I was getting on this plane. And that was just such a rock and roll moment for me. I remember just thinking, "This is something I will always remember." And I did. So that was a real. That was an exciting moment. There have been many moments like that within 6 AM that have been so incredible. Just certain scenes in my head of us being at a show and having the sun setting and me looking over at Nikki and him looking back at me and just smiling and nodding our heads and saying without any words being shared, we were just like, "Yeah, man, we did it. We're doing this." And I it's those type of moments that really were the really sh told me you're doing what you should be doing. You're doing it.
When it comes to these records, how much was there a sense that these two records might kind of put sort of a period as far as albums on the 6 a.m. story, at least for a moment? Like, was there that sense as you guys are working on these records?
I think there was. I think that there was. We never really talked about it, but I think that we knew that was going to be the period at the end of the sentence. And I think that we, I think in knowing that, we put a lot of effort into making sure that it was kind of wrapped up with a bow, which brings me back to why I'm so pleased that they're re-releasing it. with a bow, basically, as a duo. That makes me very happy. But yeah, I think we kind of knew. It was a lot, man. We were so exhausted from just writing and producing and recording and then getting out and touring and coming back and just finding any free moment to get back in the studio just to try to get these two albums done. It nearly killed me. And I think it nearly killed all of us in a way. And I think at the end of that, we just thought, I don't think that we're going to do this again.
Yeah, there's also the thing that, like, while 6 a.m. is going on, it's like there's the moment where, like, you're involved, with, helping to put together an entire Motley record. It's like just Nicky as a person and a personality, like, he's never been somebody that generally just has one thing going on. So it's like you partner up with somebody like that. And I think any of us that meet these types of people, like, we can see that, like, we've met somebody that, like, oh man, they're thinking about music in one way or another a lot of the time. So you realize you're getting thrown into a very specific blender where it's like you're not gonna have to worry about keeping busy, right?
That's right. That's exactly right. Yeah, he's amazing in that way, and I've always just been fascinated by, that just that type of person. I'm not that type of person. I focus on one thing, and I put my all into it, and I will get that done, and then I'll move on to the next thing. But he is able to very beautifully have multiple things going on and give his full attention to each one in the moment where that's necessary.
How did you guys, I don't think I know this, how did you guys meet originally? Did you know him prior to, doing the stuff with New Tattoo? Like, where did you guys kind of form the
I
bond?
did not know him
Okay.
before New Tattoo. I had gotten signed to Beyond Music, which was Alan's first record label.
Right.
And I had gotten signed as a solo artist to that. And I had made my record and was getting ready to do the promo on it. So I had some extra time on my hands. Between the time that my album was going to be released. And so Nicky, I passed him in the hallway one day at the record label. And he said, "Hey, Alan played me your album. I really like it. Would you be interested in doing some writing for the next Motley Crue record?" Because I think in that particular time, he and Tommy were not really working together. I think they were
Right.
probably maybe not speaking. And Nicky wanted to keep moving the ball forward, so he invited me into that, and we got together the very first day. We wrote, I think, three songs that ended up on the album. Then we went ahead to write most of the rest of the record together. So that was when he and I established the fact that we had a good chemistry together and that we enjoyed writing together. Even during that time, we had discussed writing for other artists, which we went ahead and did. So yeah, Nicky and I have we've known each other a long time. But it was New Tattoo that brought us together.
It had to be pretty interesting being in the fabric for that record. And of course, you really get into the whole Motley framework, again with the Saints record. Like, what was that like kind of being within the midst of that whole machine, Mick, Vince, and Tommy at that point by the time you're, collaborating on that record? What kind of sticks with you about that experience?
What sticks with me about that was when we did New Tattoo, I was really just a writer, and I did some
Right.
background vocals on that. I think Mike Klink was producing that record. Mike Klink produced that record. So I wasn't involved in the same, deeply
Correct.
immersive way that I was when we did Saints of Los Angeles. Number one, that was I put myself under a lot of pressure on that record because I understood the importance of it. I understood that this was going to be the first time that they were all four original members back together making a record since they had had their fallout. And I didn't take that lightly. I knew that this had to be. I knew that we could not fabricate the chemistry. I knew that that chemistry had to actually come back and be real, be tangible. So I spent a lot of time just with each musician individually, getting to know them, getting to know what they thought of the other musicians, learning where the challenges were going to be. That was very important to me. And by the time we actually did get it together and record, there was some real passion there. They were really committed to making a great record, and making something that honored what they had created, this genre of music that they had really been at the forefront of. So I think we all understood that this was an important record. We all understood that it had to be handled with care.
I appreciate you speaking about that because it's just like it clearly is different than having like say, new tattoo, like say some song credits on a record versus the heavy thing you talk about the weight that you felt on your shoulders of when you're stepping into a band that has a legacy like Motley Crue and helping them craft a record that you're involved in such a larger manner that you kind of take a different spot in the liner notes for the nerds that read liner notes, which I still read the liner notes, to where if the person feels like, hey man, they ruined my favorite band, it's like they're gonna look at like who are the most prominent names here in the credits that might have been responsible for this. So it's a dude, it's a heavy responsibility, man.
Listen, and there were people that thought I ruined their favorite band. I mean, that's just the reality of it. I mean, Motley fans are a tribe all of their own, and they're very devoted, and they're very committed to their love for that band. So, and I learned that as I went along, and I learned that being in 6 a.m. We got a lot of love from the Motley community for 6 a.m., but we also got some pushback, and I certainly understood that pushback, and that was always a little bit of a delicate thing to have to walk that line.
We mentioned briefly Sammy Hagar earlier, and as a guy that has 5150 in his phone number, did you write more than just the one song with Sammy? Like, what was that experience like?
No, I just wrote that one song, and he was so great. I remember this so well. I was living in Los Angeles at the time, and I was married at the time, and I remember my wife said to me, "Hey, aren't you going up to write with Sammy Hagar tomorrow?" And I was like, "Yeah, I am." She's like, "Do you have anything ready for it?" And I was like, "I really don't. I guess I should come up with something." So I just sat down with an acoustic guitar, and I basically wrote the first verse and chorus of the song A Little Bit More. And it happened very, it came out very, very quickly. So I figured, okay, I've got this. At least I've got a start. I've got something to show up with. So I pack up my guitar, I head up to Northern California, and I meet Sammy at his house, and he's just wonderful. He's just the coolest guy. But I remember, and so then we sat down in his living room. And I pulled out my guitar, and I remember thinking to myself, James, you did not spend very much time on this. What if this song just sucks? And I just got flushed with like fear. I thought, I really didn't. I mean, I spent maybe 15, 20 minutes on it, and that was it. So I played him the verse and the chorus, and he's like, "Man, I love that." He goes, "I don't know if I could sing that though." And I'm like, "Dude, you're Sammy. You can sing anything." So I played it again, and he sang it, and man, his voice just echoed through his house, and I was like, "Oh yeah, this is happening. This is, and that was a moment that I will never forget. So, but we only did that one song, and I loved that song. I felt like that song never really had the life that I thought maybe it could,
Yeah.
because he really got it. He really he got where I was coming from in that original little piece that I brought in, and I thought he just nailed it. And I just, I love his voice. His voice is he's a very underrated singer, even though I know he gets plenty of praise.
I
You can
totally
never
agree.
praise Sammy for enough for that voice.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I'm not going to go down the Sammy rabbit hole, but you brought up something that is interesting. And just for as a collaborator, you almost went to that session and didn't have anything. Did that happen where you would go in to like kind of a co-writing session with nothing? And did you come out with good results? Because it's like some folks, like as you know, it's like people are all sometimes a little bit different as far as how they prepare for going into a co-writing situation like that. Like some people like to go in with a bunch of song ideas, and some people just like to get in the room and see what comes out.
I like to always come in with something. And in the case of the Sammy song, like even though I didn't spend a lot of time on it, something told me that we were onto something good there. I have shown up to sessions before without anything or with just real crap ideas. And sometimes, then you're just maybe relying on the other person having something great. And sometimes you can just get lucky, or I have gone in with nothing and come out with something great before. That does happen, but typically that would be a risky move. I would like to show up with something kind of flushed out, because number one, if you're writing with an artist, the artist appreciates that. They appreciate the fact that you've done some research. You've studied their voice, you've studied their songs. You're taking this seriously. I think that puts you in a better position with them. I think that builds some trust maybe early on in the writing process, and trust is very important. So yeah, I would always recommend going in with something, and usually two or three things. Have a couple of backups.
Yeah, it's just always an interesting place to be because just like I've talked to a lot of artists that like say had like the publishing deal where, especially like in the old days, like you had to write X number of songs per year. It's like, and so it's just like there was that quota that in a sense is hanging over your head for some of those guys that that's why they would sometimes go into a lot of those different co-writing sessions, like, either really prepared or just going to see what comes out because just like ultimately whatever does come out. Okay, hopefully it's one more thing that's going to go towards that quota. So it's a really, it seems like, and I don't know how much you fell into that just as far as like the publishing quota and all that kind of stuff, but it's a really interesting conundrum to be in as a creative person, it would seem.
It is. I was very fortunate to get into the producing side of things pretty early on, and that always kind of gave you an advantage because sometimes you're going in and the band has already written most of the record, but maybe some of their songs just need punching up. Maybe this one just the verse just isn't quite working, but the chorus is really great. And as the producer, if you're a producer writer, then there's an opportunity there for you to write on a lot of music. And as a producer, I found that that was the case. So I would end up getting multiple cuts on an album, not just one or maybe two if I was just a songwriter, but because I was the producer as well. Yeah, I got very lucky. I got a lot of songs on a lot of records just by being in the room.
Last couple things here. It seems like you formed a, when you talk about like getting songs on records, like it seems like you formed, some sort of pretty good bond with Meatloaf because you ended up doing stuff with him on a number of his records here kind of in the later period. Like, so, like, what's kind of the bond that you found with him? Because it seems like it was pretty fruitful.
Meatloaf was amazing. In fact, he was really the first person to take me under his wing. When I the very first show I ever did in Los Angeles, when I was getting ready to promote my Inhale album, he came to that show, and which I was so excited about because I was a big Meatloaf fan. My brother had turned me on to him when I was just a kid, and it was a really cool thing. And the next day, he called me. I got a phone call from an unknown number, and I was like, "Hello," and he's like, "Hey, James, this is Meat." And I'm like, "Meat, like Meatloaf?" And he's like, "Yeah, I was at your show last night and I made some notes. And I was wondering, would you be open to hearing some notes from me on your performance and on your songs?" And he proceeded to take about an hour on the phone with me, just giving me amazing advice about performance and about singing and about pacing your set. And I knew at that moment, this is a really special guy. You know, the fact that he took that time to share his thoughts and really help me an awful lot. So the fact that we grew to be great friends, and he invited me in and had me write a lot of his music was just it was life and career changing for me, and I really cherish that friendship, and I miss him. He's an amazing guy.
Yeah, here's where I'll wrap. I mean, that like it makes it's always made a lot of sense to me that you did the amount of work that you did with him, because like I see and hear the same love that obviously he had like for building those classic productions with Jim Steinman. Like it seems like you have that same love in building just these epic productions with the 6 a.m. material. Like it's just like it's not a hard set of dots to connect. Like looking at like when you hear those records, like of course this guy could hang with a guy like Meatloaf. It makes total sense when you hear what you've done, even just with 6 a.m.
Meatloaf was the first and only guy that when I turned in a 7-minute song to him, he said, "This is great, but can you make it longer?" And I was just like, "Oh, I love this. I love this." I had such a blast working with him.
That's fantastic, man. What's up ahead for you? What are you working on presently?
Well, I actually I'm retired. I'm doing very little music. I have a couple little projects that I do just for joy. And I am doing some teaching actually at a local performing arts school here in Derry, Northern Ireland. And
Fantastic.
I'm just loving that. These kids are so talented, and it's fun. You know, as you can probably tell, I love talking about music. I love sharing my experiences. And so this just plays into that nicely. I've really found a really wonderful community here, and you know. And I do a weekly podcast where I just kind of I just it's actually not even really a podcast. I call it kind of thought essays where I just talk about my experiences in the music business. And I just put it out on YouTube, and people listen to it, and I have a community of people that I kind of, you know, talk back and forth with about it, and I'm just enjoying the heck out of that.
That's awesome, man. That's one of the best things when you get to that point where you can kind of give back and share that knowledge and all that. Well, James, thank you so much for the time. I don't want to take any more of yours, but I do like the idea of podcasts as thought essays. I think that's a better way to start referring to it. But thank you, man. This was a lot of fun.
Yeah, thank you very much. Yeah, if you want to check it out, it's just James Michael Official on YouTube. Check it out. I put one out every Sunday.
We've reached the end of another episode of the UCR podcast. It is Matt Wardlaw. We appreciate you listening. If you enjoy what you're hearing, please rate and review wherever you are listening and hit subscribe so that you'll receive future episodes of the podcast from Ultimate Classic Rock.